where we came from, where we've been. They're eternal questions that say a lot about where we're going as the human race. Welcome to Ancient Mysteries on the Air. Welcome to Ancient Mysteries on the Air. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. And we have a fantastic topic for today. If you talk about ancient mysteries, you have to talk about Atlantis. And a new book out that I think you will enjoy is Atlantis in the Caribbean and the Comet that Changed the World. And today's guest is Andrew Collins. Now, Andrew is a great person to have written this book because he's been investigating the idea of advanced civilizations in prehistory since 1979. He's the co-discoverer of a massive cave complex beneath the Giza Plateau, now known as Collins's Cave. The author of From the Ashes of Angels, Gods of Eden, The Cygnus Mystery, and Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods. He lives in England, and we're so glad to have him with us today. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Jim. How's everything over there?
Well, it's okay. We got connected on Skype. I'm glad of that. So we did get connected. That's the good thing. So let me ask you, a lot of people think when they read about Plato and Atlantis, they think it's this big parable, this metaphor that it didn't really exist. Why do you think that's wrong-headed?
Well, I mean, firstly, I think that the main spur of trying to investigate Atlantis is the fact that it's one of these eternal mysteries which everybody wants to solve. You know, it's like, who was Jack the Ripper, or is there aliens or whatever? I mean, it's almost like a holy grail. You know, why do people quest for the holy grail? It's because it's there, you know. And I think that this is the answer to this, is the fact that over the last 200 years, literally thousands of books and articles have been written on this subject, many of them postulating different theories, of course, particularly relating to its location. Many written to suggest that it doesn't even exist and it's just a metaphor for something else. However, it's a subject which I have had particular interest in for a great many years, most of my life, to be honest. I mean, I remember writing about it when I was on a magazine back in the late 70s, you know, new discoveries from a Russian vessel in the Atlantic came across, you know, some underwater ruins. You know, was it Atlantis? And this is the sort of stuff which comes up perennially. It always fascinated me, to the point that I wanted to try and investigate it myself. And a few years ago, I was actually given a book contract by a publisher to do a book on Atlantis. And my initial thoughts were that it was something to do with Antarctica. And the reason for this was that there'd been books out by Graham Hancock, Charles Hapgood, Rose and Rand Flemath, who had all postulated the fact that Antarctica could have been inhabited in the Ice Age, and that, that there was probably activity there more recently than what people imagine. However, I thought, well, that's fine, but I'm going to go back to basics. I'm going to go to the original sources for the account of Atlantis, and they come from Plato. Now, he was obviously the Greek Athenian philosopher. He wrote around 350 BC, and he included the initial Atlantis account in his work known as the Timaeus. It was relatively brief, and the rest of the Timaeus was about scientific, cosmological facts and different theories of the times, which were very profound in their own right. But he mentions Atlantis in a few pages, and then he goes on to write about it again in a second book that's known as the Critias, which is unfinished, and it's solely about Atlantis. So what I did was I found every single one of those pages and I photocopied them and I put them all the way around my kitchen so that every day when I cooked or I had breakfast or whatever, I would just be staring at them. And they were large as well. I mean, I think they were A3 in size. You know, so quite some size, which is sort of, I don't know if you have A3 over there, but it's sort of double the size of you know, American letter, if you like, size. And basically what I tried to do was familiarise myself with every single word that Plato said on the subject so that I had a perfect overview from which to launch my own investigation. And the first thing that became apparent was that it had nothing to do with Atlantis whatsoever, with Antarctica whatsoever, because he says certain obvious facts, particularly in the Timaeus, which I think is more factual than its follow-up, the Critias. The Critias is much more romantic about this beautiful city and beautiful civilization and idealistic principles and how it all went wrong. The main facts are in the first account, the Timaeus, and basically what he says is that Atlantis is a large island continent. It exists beyond the Pillars of Hercules. Now, these were the two rocks that marked the exit of the Mediterranean as you enter what he refers to and what was referred to generally at the time as the Atlantic Sea, not the ocean, the sea, the Atlantic Sea. And he says that basically beyond the Atlantic Sea is where Atlantis could be found. Although, bearing in mind, he doesn't actually use the term Atlantis in that account. He calls it the Atlantic Island. That's what he calls it. And he says that ancient voyagers from his own world were once able to reach the Atlantic Island. And that from here to the opposite continent, there was a series of smaller islands that enabled those voyagers to reach this opposite continent. Now, this opposite continent can only be the American continent, because quite clearly, if you sail out of the Mediterranean and essentially go west, you're going to hit the Americas at some point. So, you know, this is not China, this is not Japan, this is not Southeast Asia. This is the American continent. That's what he's talking about here, very specifically. And these islands used as stepping stones clearly are what was used by the earliest Europeans to reach the same area. And this is either the Lesser Antilles, which stretch from the three big Greater Antilles islands, which are obviously Cuba, Hispaniola, and Puerto Rico, or they're the Bahamas, which were also used as stepping stones by ancient mariners to reach the American continent, most obviously Florida. And that's what he seems to be suggesting, but there's further evidence of this, because he says that Atlantis was destroyed in one single day and night of earthquakes and floods. Now, we'll come on to what that is in a moment, but he says that the island therefore sank, and in its place are shallows and mud shoals. Now, this might sound a very vague statement,
right,
but these same terms are used by other ancient writers from the same age as Plato, and they add something vital with this, and that's the fact that in the same area was a vast sea of seaweed. Now, that can only be one place, and that's the Sargasso Sea. And that's this vast area of seaweed, quite literally, that stretches from the mid-Atlantic all the way to the very edges of the Bahamas. So that's the rough area. And we know that ancient Phoenician and Carthaginian vessels were reaching as far as the Sargasso Sea. So that's a fact. These are your ancient mariners, ultimately. I mean, certainly from the perspective of Plato's age. And the mud shoals and the shallow waters almost certainly are those of the Bahamas, which lay immediately beyond the Sargasso Sea. And as anybody has been to the Bahamas will know, you know, the waters there are no more than 10 to 15 feet in depth. For the most part, they're no more than 6 to 10. And of course, they are treacherous and hazardous for any types of vessels, and many, many ships have been wrecked, particularly on rocky shoals, which, you know, occasionally are there within the Bahamas. And of course, if ancient mariners were actually reaching this area, the whole lot has become slightly confused together, so that the sea of seaweed, the Sargasso Sea, and these mud shoals are all confused together, because we certainly know that there are no, you know, shallow waters underneath the Sargasso Sea. You know, it's thousands of feet deep there. So that's not the case. But it's information, it's snippets of information which are obviously reaching the Mediterranean world, reaching the philosophical schools, which Plato and his contemporaries frequent. And of course, they would debate the subjects of the day. They would debate, you know, whether the Earth was the center of the universe or whether the sun was. They would debate about stars and about the nature of air and wind and all this sort of stuff. And they would also have debated about what lay on the other side of the Atlantic Sea, probably based upon information that was being received by mariners that were reaching that far. So, of course, the next question comes, you know, what is Atlantis itself? Well, all the indications are from the second of Plato's accounts, the Critias, is that it's the area of Cuba, or certainly that Cuba seems to be the flagship that he's describing. It's essentially the same size. There is a huge range of mountains that border the northern limits of it, exactly as he says. There's a massive plain to the south, which is exactly what he says. And there are a number of other geographical and topographical indications that he give, which fit Cuba better than any other candidate, better than Hispaniola, better than Puerto Rico. And that's another indication that this area is very important. But of course, Cuba is still there today. It hasn't sunk. But what we do know is that immediately to the north of Cuba and accessed via just a very narrow channel of water was the Great Bahama Bank and the Little Bahama Bank. Now, these were formerly two large land masses, certainly the size of Cuba, possibly even larger, that existed through until the end of the last ice age and were drowned eventually when the rising waters of the ice sheets that were gradually melting at the end of the last ice age reached this region and drowned all low-lying areas, not just of the Bahamas, to leave the thousands of islands and caves that we have today, but also all of the low-lying regions around the area of, you know, let's say Cuba, Jamaica, all the rest of it, which were once almost linked through another series of islands. Perhaps these were even the islands that Plato himself was referring to. So now we have an area. So was there any kind of high culture living in there? Well, yes, there was.
Yeah, that was the question I was going to ask. I mean, when we think about how we talk about an advanced civilization, the question is how advanced?
Well, I mean, well, firstly, you have to say to yourself, well, we're talking about the time period that he gives is around 9,600 BC. And although scholars and academics for hundreds of years have suggested that Plato must have been wrong, you know, nobody existed, there was no civilizations existing in 9,600 BC, particularly ones that were destroyed, you know, and that's led to a lot of theories suggesting that maybe he wasn't talking about solar years, that he was talking about lunar months, or maybe he was talking about solar months, or maybe he got the figures wrong that he saw written down on some ancient tablet, and maybe he meant 100 instead of 1,000. But all of these are excuses to try and prevent us looking at the greater date that he gives, which is 9,600 BC, because we know that, firstly, that's exactly when the Bahamas did start to sink under the water, when all these meltwaters were coming down along, for instance, the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico and raising the waters. But prior to this time, there had been a cataclysm that had wiped out at least 75% of the North American population. And this was what's known today as the Younger Dryas impact event. And this seems to have been caused by a comet impact that occurred approximately 10,800 BC and created shockwaves and repercussions for several hundred years afterwards. And this would have involved hundreds and thousands of fragments of a comet breaking up as they entered into the atmosphere and probably even exploding before they'd even reached the Earth, but in doing so created wildfires across the North American continent, and probably as far even as Europe and the Middle East. And this set a chain reaction off of fires across the whole of the continent and, you know, obviously in the Eurasian continent as well. but also it blotted out the sun with obviously the smoke and the ash to debris going into the upper atmosphere. And this itself created a chain reaction that brought about a mini ice age that lasted around 1,200 years. And with this would have been massive tsunamis that would have swirled around the Atlantic and obviously other oceans for, again, probably weeks, if not months. And these would have temporarily have drowned all low-lying regions, including the Bahamas. So now we can begin to see that, you know, that Plato could have been right when he said that Plato was drowned. Not in one, you know, terrible day and night. I think that that is a little bit of a fantasy, but certainly in a very short space of time. But what was it drowning? Who was it drowning? Well, we know that when the first Europeans reached the Americas after 1492 and the voyages of Christopher Columbus, that they went deep into the interiors of these islands of the Bahamas and the Caribbean, and they talked to local people and they told them about their old stories and traditions. And unanimously, everywhere, they heard about a great cataclysm that had torn apart a former landmass that had existed in that area and that had drowned it. Not once, but twice was the stories. Firstly, probably through tsunamis, and secondly, through the rising of the melt of the sea levels caused by the meltwater coming down from the ice sheets of North America. And also, they talked about a serpent in the sky. They talked about the old moon falling into the ocean, and various other metaphors, which were quite clearly a reference to some kind of cosmic event. Now, okay, these were told to, you know, Spanish, you know, other chroniclers that were in the area at the at the end of the 15th, beginning of the 16th century.
Right.
But what if, and this is what I try to show in the book Atlantis and the Caribbean, what if these same stories were told to ancient mariners, the Phoenicians and the Carthaginians, of which I build a good case to show that they were definitely trading and reaching the Bahamas, the Caribbean, and the American mainland, almost certainly within the Gulf of Mexico, certainly by the first millennium BC, arguably even much earlier, perhaps during the second millennium BC, and perhaps even before that. There is so much overwhelming evidence of transatlantic contact going on at this time that I think that this becomes a very good bridge for the information coming out of the Bahamas and the Caribbean and reaching the Mediterranean world and the philosophical schools where Plato himself was obviously a part of and debating these subjects. And of course, they end up going in his dialogues, which, although contain an awful lot of scientific information, must actually be seen as fictional, because these dialogues are the coming together of certain personalities of the near past. People like, you know, Socrates and various other, you know, figures. And they sit around a table and they debate. That's the way these dialogues, that's why they're called dialogues. They're dialogues between historical personages. And they say, you know, Socrates, what news have you, you know? And this is how the information is conveyed within these dialogues. So in some strange way, they're almost like the X-Files of their day. You know, they are bringing in real information of what we would see as real information, and they are putting them into the public domain via these dialogues. But the other question that we haven't answered is the high culture. What was going on in this Atlantis, if we want to see it in terms of the Caribbean and the Bahamas? Well, over the last 50 years, a large number of underwater ruins have been discovered off of the coasts of many Bahaman islands, particularly Bimini in north in the northern part of the Great Bahama Bank, including the so-called Bimini Road in 1968, which is this huge J-shaped formation of stone blocks, which was probably used as some kind of quay or dock or breakwater for boats to moor onto it. And it's made of local beach rock, but they've been moved into place. I mean, they are not in their natural position. They're probably not made by, you know, Atlanteans, because it's probably too late. However, there are many other structures, particularly one of interest that's only come up in the past 5 or so years, known as Brown's Ruins, which has been located in the extreme south of Bimini. And this is a massive strewn field of stone blocks made of a very hard metamorphic rock known as schist, blue schist. And this is not indigenous to the Bahamas at all. The nearest sources from there is Jamaica, Cuba, and Hispaniola. And there are a few other sources actually in Europe, in Italy and in Turkey. And that's it. There, you know, it's not native. And yet this massive strewn field is in a teardrop shape, which suggests that it's been smacked from one side, possibly by a tsunami, to destroy perhaps what was once some kind of structure. And many of these blocks do appear to have been cut and dressed. And they are massive, long, and plus they're a round pillar, not like Ionian pillars from Greece, but just round column blocks. And, you know, this needs explanation. I mean, and this is over several hundred yards in each direction. This is not the strewn ballast from a vessel that has sunk there. I mean, obviously, vessels in European and colonial times would often be filled with large stone blocks from quarries. And, of course, if they got shipwrecked, then all of that would be strewn on the sea bottom. And this has often been mistaken, particularly in the Bahamas, as evidence of some kind of ruined temple, because some of them would even contain things like Ionic pillars that were destined for some kind of, you know, manor house or something, you know, in Virginia or somewhere like that. But this is different. There is definitely something there with Brown's Ruins. And it's not simply whole strewn fields of rock, and cut blocks. I mean, there are a number of underwater caves that have stone carvings in. Now, these are perhaps now 15 feet or more beneath the surface. They would have been above water 2,000, 3,000, maybe 4,000 BC. Again, that's not Atlantis times, but it certainly tells us that in the Bahamas, for instance, there were people there at that time. And I think it's important to point out that officially archaeologists do not accept that there was any occupation of the Bahamas until at least 500 to 600 AD, which is ridiculous. Going to places like Cuba, it's different. The official record is that there were people on Cuba by about 5,000 to 6,000 BC. However, there was almost certainly people at much earlier age. I mean, hardly anything of Cuba has been touched in archaeology. Very little was done during the Spanish occupation. Very little was done during the time of independence. Very little was done, obviously, during the communist regime, which obviously still continues to this day. And there are vast, vast areas of the interior of Cuba which nobody has even looked at. And there were reports from the 19th century of all sorts of strange idols and structures and carvings being found in the interior of Cuba, any of which could be part of a lost civilization.
Now, you have an interesting section in the book that has a lot of imagery and a lot of artifacts and different paintings and things. In terms of some of the visual evidence, some of the things we'll see in there, would you like to tell us about some of the things we'll see in that section? Because I thought that was fascinating.
Well, I mean, obviously that there are a number of things in there, including one of the pictures of the underwater petroglyphs off of one of the islands of the Bahamas. I mean, this is a remarkable picture. I mean, as I said, this was taken underwater. This proves that there were people in the Bahamas several thousand years ago. I mean, you know, just that one picture alone. And it came from a deep sea diver, Herb Sawinski, who did a hell of a lot of work and uncovered a lot of evidence of human activity underwater in the Bahamas over the years. Plus, you'll also see images of these other underwater structures, including Brown's ruins and various other things like the Andros platform. Now, this is a structure which my colleagues, Greg and Laura Little, who have done so much to record these archaeological features in the Bahamas over the last 10 years, pictures from them, a reconstruction of another huge dock or quay that was used thousands of years ago off Andros Island, which is the largest of the islands of the Bahamas. And this is on the northeast of the island, at a place called just off of Nichols Town. And again, it cannot be explained. I mean, you know, this is not something that, you know, it's made of beach rock. It's massive, hundreds of yards long. It's a structure. Somebody built it. And, you know, there is no answers as to who that might be. It could have been mariners from the ancient world, maybe Phoenicians, Carthaginians. You know, it could have been an indigenous people, maybe the forerunners of the Maya, for instance. I mean, for instance, there is a number of legends in Central America that talk about the origins of the tribes, the seven tribes, as they're legendarily called, coming from an island in the east that fits the bill of Cuba again. It's referred to in some of the texts as the old red land. I think it's Talapan is the actual name. And this place presumably was known because of it was red. Now, if you go to Cuba, the plain of Cuba, the oil, the soil is blood red, basically. I mean, it's incredibly red. I mean, I've never seen soil so red. In fact, I was so stunned when I went there that I had to bring some back, you know, to show people. I still got it today, actually, in this house. And, you know, you can imagine that if this was a fertile land that was seen as almost like a sort of, you know, a utopia that the forerunners of the Mesoamerican peoples had come from, they would call it that, the old red land. And it was said that on this island was a place called Chukumoztoc. Now, this is actually the name that's given in Mexico or in Nahuatl, which is the language of the Aztecs, although the Maya have their own form of the name. And this was some kind of underground structure that was presumably sevenfold. And it was said that the earliest peoples emerged from this cave and they then migrated to the mainland and founded the different cultures of Mesoamerica. Now, I think I found that the seven caves. I think that they're on somewhere known as the Isle of Pines, which is off the extreme southwest corner of Cuba. I mean, I visited it. I went there. It's today a very hostile area as far as the undergrowth and nature is concerned. Plus, it's off limits to you know, to tourists and members of the general public. And it was going there into these caves and seeing the most beautiful petroglyphs, many of which take the form of concentric circles that seem to be overlaid in strange patterns. It came to me for the very first time that what I was seeing here was some kind of abstract memory of a impact event. And I started to investigate thereafter whether such an impact event had occurred in the Caribbean. And eventually I realized that what was being described was this Younger Dryas impact event. So in other words, even though these petroglyphs may have been painted many thousands of years after the event, it was still retaining this memory, this strong memory of this cataclysm that had taken place in that region. So, you know, that's in a nutshell what the book contains. There is a lot of material trying to prove that transoceanic contact took place, because that's essential to build that bridge between, you know, the East and West, if you like, of showing that Plato could have obtained that material from mariners who had reached the Western Atlantic seaboard by his eye. And there are even further clues within his own writings that this material came from Phoenicians or Carthaginians, because he talks about the language of the Atlanteans in there. And when he does so, he quotes names which are very clearly of Semitic origin. You know, in other words, they're not Atlantean, they're Semitic. And Western Semitic language was the language both of the Phoenicians and their sister colony, the Carthaginians. And I take this further in the book and show that many of the names that are linked, you know, not just with the Atlantic account, but also with the areas of Northwest Africa, which do feature in the book, like obviously Atlas itself. I mean, Atlas, for instance, was the name given to a mountain in Western Africa, which was the last feature that mariners would see before the west coast of Africa disappeared. And this was said to be the god Atlas carrying the world on his shoulders, which is one of the reasons why, in fact, arguably the main reason for why the sea there was actually called the Atlantic Sea. It means that the Sea of Atlas, basically. So the big island within it was obviously the island of not just the Atlantic, but the island of Atlas, which of course is one of the reasons why Atlas features in the stories to do with Atlantis that Plato himself gives us.
Well, it's a fascinating topic. If someone is interested in the topic of Atlantis, I see no reason why they wouldn't want to pick up this book. It seemed to me to be a must read. So the question is, Andrew, where can people find it?
Well, try the obvious, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. But if you come onto my website, andrewcollins.com, right on the front news page, there's a big splash about the book. You can click through to, to these sites there. And there are various articles that I've linked that I've written in the past to do with Atlantis that you can read for free straight away. And I, you know, would advise that. And just out there, I mean, people get a lot of theories given to them about where Atlantis is. But before you accept them, just read what Plato says. He was the guy that came up with the story, and then make up your own minds.
Fascinating stuff. Our guest today has been Andrew Collins. The book is Atlantis in the Caribbean and the Comet That Changed the World, and certainly well worth reading if you are interested in the topic of Atlantis. I think you'd have to be, because the name of this show is Ancient Mysteries on the Air. So there you have it. We thank you so much for joining us, and I'm sure that Andrew would agree. Keep exploring those mysteries. We'll talk to you next time.